Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Welcome to CJSF 90.1 FM here broadcasting from Vancouver Burnaby Mountain. My name is Chris Spangenberg and I am the producer of this series of interviews. Now this is the fourth episode of an eight-part episodic series on traditional Chinese medicine, also known as TCM, and the traditional Chinese medicine community here in Vancouver. In the course of these interviews, I examine the local culture and practice of traditional Chinese medicine, as well as inquire into its philosophy and difference from Western medicinal practices. This series is produced for CJSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. Today's interview is the second half of a long interview with Dr. Yvonne Evan, an acupuncturist, herbalist, translator, and clinic owner of Rocky Mountain Wellness in Port Moody. Yvonne stands out in the TCM community for his interest and scholarship in classical Chinese medicine, especially classical Chinese medicine texts such as the Yellow Emperor's Classic of Chinese Medicine and the Treatise on Cold Damage Disorders. He is also involved with translation of such texts into English. In this last part of the interview with Yvonne, we talk about the differences between classical Chinese medicine and the conventional model of TCM, as well as the importance of the scholarship and translation of the old Chinese medicine texts. We begin with discussing the significant differences between classical Chinese medicine and contemporary TCM as practiced today. Next, we talk about the importance of the translation of classical Chinese texts into English and Yvonne's methods of translation. Yvonne elucidates on his call for a classical revival and briefly discusses what academic and institutional changes would best foster a return to classical Chinese medicine. We end the interview examining the Taoist origins of Chinese medicine. My name is Chris Spangenberg and you are listening to an interview between me and Dr. Yvonne Evan here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Significant differences between classical Chinese medicine as you practice it and the conventional model of TCM taught in modern China.
That's a very important question. I think that this is a big area of division right now that's happening is that, you know, there's a lot of practitioners who feel that after in the 50s when they institutionalized Chinese medicine, they really, really watered it down. They condensed it in a way that they wanted to basically educate it and teach it in a very shortened way. And so what they had done was they had diluted a lot of the old classical literature and stuff and really put a focus on biomedicalizing the medicine and putting it, you know, into fancy little boxes and making it easy to learn and stuff, which unfortunately, I mean, this is the way it's being taught. This is the way it's being taught in the mainland. This is the way it's being taught really everywhere around the world right now. And that is what we now consider traditional Chinese medicine. And it's a very, very big difference from classical Chinese medicine. Classical Chinese medicine really puts a lot of emphasis in the old classical texts and things like the Huangdi Neijing, which is the Yellow Emperor's internal classic, and reading more Taoist texts and even delving into a little bit of Confucian texts, but also putting a lot more emphasis on the clinical handbooks, things like the Shanghan Lun, which I had mentioned before, and the Jingwei Yawei, and many other writings that followed suit. And really, classical Chinese medicine is, I mean, it depends on who you ask, but some people will say classical Chinese medicine is, you know, up until the Han Dynasty, so it ended in the late 200s, and some people will say classical Chinese medicine is anything that refers to pre-Mao medicine, and what they mean by pre-Mao medicine is when Mao Zedong called for the revival of Chinese medicine and institutionalized it. And so it really depends on who you ask. I think that essentially, you know, there are differences, of course, in treatment outcome. I don't really know. I mean, because modern TCM, there's nothing really wrong with modern TCM. When it's applied correctly, it can be very effective. I'm by no means, you know, going to allude to the possibility that it's not effective or it doesn't work. I just think that in my own opinion, in my own love for the medicine, I think that there really needs to be a return to the classics, because I think that that's where the real medicine is. And a good analogy that one of my teachers actually used, which I really, really love, is that, you know, he likens classical Chinese medicine to a spring in the Himalayas, like a very small spring that eventually moves into a river, which essentially will continue to run along its course into a lake and then break off into trajectories and then dump into the Yangtze River and then eventually meet all the way into China, into the Bohai Sea and into the ocean. And so his analogy for that is that classical Chinese medicine is like that spring in the Himalayas. It's very pure. It's very clean. It's unadulterated, and modern TCM might be more like the meeting of the Yangtze River and the ocean, that it's gone through a lot of changes, and it might have been a little bit more murky now and a little bit more polluted. And so I think it's a bit of an extreme analogy, but I think most people would get the point behind that.
What academic and institutional changes would best foster a return to classical Chinese medicine?
Essentially, what the institutions would have to do would put more emphasis on the classics, on really, really having a classical revival and having the students read the texts more. I think that, you know, it is changing, though. There are a lot more classical courses being taught at the universities, more so at the graduate and the postgraduate level. I think at the undergraduate level, whether it's in North America or Europe or in China, there's still an expectation of you know, the curriculum that needs to be taught and stuff, and there's very little emphasis really on the classics. So you really have to get into the much higher levels, into the graduate and postgraduate studies to do that. And in fact, actually, at my university, at Nanjing University of Chinese Medicine right now, in October, they're opening up a department through the university, and it's the Jingfang department through the Nanjing University, which the emphasis there will be 100% on reviving the classics and putting a lot of emphasis on classical education and really, really focusing on the Shanghan Zabinglun and all the clinical herbal texts that were so important at that time.
Where were the best experts in classical Chinese medicine to be found?
All over the place. I don't think that they're limited to just to China. There are a lot of wonderful, wonderful practitioners in China, but there's also a lot of great practitioners in North America and in Europe. I think it really depends. I think there, over the last 10 or 15 years, I really believe that there has been a classical revival. It really is different now than it was 10 or 15 years ago. And so you've got a lot of people who have returned to China, who have really worked under discipleship with very, very, very important doctors and are doing a really beautiful, beautiful job in bringing the classics back to the West, and even to the East for that matter. I've seen a lot of classical conferences happen in China that bring out hundreds and hundreds of people. So I really do think that there is really a classical revival. There's also a book that came out, I don't know how many years, maybe about 10 years ago, maybe even longer, by a doctor named Liu Lihong. He's a Chinese doctor based out of Guangxi University, and he wrote a book. It's in Chinese. I believe it is being translated right now into English, but it's called the Si Kao Zhong Yi. So it's exploring Chinese medicine, and he really, really delves very deep into the need for a classical revival and discusses in very fine detail about the problems with modern traditional Chinese medicine and why it's important to return to the source of our teachings.
Could you talk a little about the importance of the translation of ancient Chinese medicine texts? Why is translation of the literature so important?
Because there's so little of it. I think that's the problem. I think that right now in Chinese medicine, if you were going to go into a Chinese library at a Chinese university, it is overwhelming. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books, journals, articles that in Chinese about Chinese medicine, spanning, you know, the Shang Dynasty to modern day writings. It really is quite overwhelming and exciting if you're me as well. But the rough estimate right now is that maybe 2-3% of major texts have been translated into English or into other languages. And to me, I mean, that number is far too low. If somebody wanted to really explore classical studies in English, they would be very limited. I mean, there are a number of books out there. It's much better than it used to be, but there's still very, very little. And so to have only 2 or 3% available to English speakers of what is available to Chinese speakers is really it's just too little. So I believe that one of the most important things we can do right now in order to support this classical revival and to really bring back the classics and the importance is we just need to translate more and more and more and get as many books out there, as many articles as possible. I mean, this is part of why I started my case study blog many years ago, was to translate as much as possible. And also the book that I had published a couple years ago is just, you know, a small step towards adding to the literature that we've got available in English.
How many people do you know are involved in a translation work?
Offhand, I know several people that are involved in translation, but it's still a small community. I don't know the exact number, but we're not talking about hundreds or thousands, really. Translating Chinese to English is one thing, but to get into a very specific specialized field of translating Chinese medicine into English, I mean, it's quite small. It's really not big. It's not big enough for that matter. I don't know the exact numbers, but we need more. We need more.
Could you talk briefly about your methods of translation?
Sure. My method essentially is to read the text in its entirety, and then I'll read it again as best that I can, and I'm going to try to understand the methods of the writer, the writer's influences, try to really get into the head of the writer and, you know, understand, you know, political situation, environmental situation of that time, depending on where, on what time period we're reading. And once I feel like I have a bit of an understanding of what the text is saying and the style of the writer and the message that he's trying to convey, then I'll start to break it down and start to translate it and really just try to break it down. I mean, it's a lengthy process. I know some wonderful translators who can really translate very, very quickly and produce beautiful, beautiful work. I'm a little bit slow in the sense that I'm very anal and meticulous about my work, and I worry about it and overthink it sometimes. So it takes me quite a bit of time. But the process is essentially read again, understand, begin to translate, and then eventually just start editing so it actually makes sense.
In your experience, what are the best publication outlets that publish translations of ancient Chinese medicine literature and contemporary Chinese medicine literature?
There's only a few, really. I think that as far as the people that are publishing, there's a publishing house called Paradigm Publications. There's Eastland Press. There's a few others their names are just slipping me right now. But I think that what's happening right now in our field is a lot of people are leaning towards self-publishing. And I think that the reason that people are self-publishing is because they've got more control of their work. And in this day and age with social media, and because of how small the community really is, it's not hard to let people know about your work. You know, there also is a great publishing house, in my opinion, and this is the same publishing house that I published my text with. They're called the Chinese Medicine Database, and they're based out of Portland, Oregon. And their primary objective is to get as many classical texts translated as possible. And I think to date, they've published probably about 9 or 10 very important works. And the fellow behind that project, Jonathan Schell, is really, really committed to getting as many books out there as possible. And I think what they're doing for the field of classical Chinese medicine is truly amazing.
How has your experience as a student and translator of the Chinese language changed your understanding of Chinese medicine?
I feel like I had to relearn the medicine. I think that once I started to learn Chinese, I went back to a lot of the basic textbooks, and because I felt that I wasn't being given the whole picture. You know, a lot of the books that we were using in school in English weren't necessarily translations of mainland texts or anything. A lot of these texts were writers' opinions of the theories and philosophies behind the medicine. And I mean, there were some good ones. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some great English texts out there, but I feel like I really had to go back and learn. And I think that one of the greatest things that I've experienced and that I've really noticed is understanding the nuances behind certain words, where, you know, where you're taught that a word can mean something and you attach your, you know, your clinical perspectives and your strategies to that word, whereas in Chinese that word can mean many, many things. And it's learning how to interpret those words that really opened up a lot for me, and it really helped me open up the possibilities to a lot of classical texts. I think that a lot of people feel that a lot of these texts are very limited, and how can we treat, you know, modern day patients with, you know, with books that were written 1800 years ago? And I think the problem with that is that people are not reading between the lines, and again, they're not really understanding that this is a physiology based medicine, and that's really, physiology hasn't changed in 2,000 years. The body still reacts the way the body reacts. External influences are different, but it's still going to react and change very similar.
In your view, what are the most important medical texts of Chinese medicine still in need of translation into English?
Too many lists. There are so many books, but I can say from my own opinion, and this is probably based more on my preferences, is more commentaries on the classical texts. It's a great tradition in Chinese medicine to take an old classical text, for example, the Shanghan Zaping Lun, and write a commentary on it. And that would just literally be that writer's interpretation. And that is where I spend a lot of my time reading. I read a lot of commentaries. There's a lot of really great writers and thinkers in Chinese medicine over the last 2,000 years, clearly. And so I think that we really need to focus on translating a lot of these commentaries, because they're just too good and can really, really open up a whole new perspective for practitioners.
How can the TCM community better support this translation work?
I'm really not sure. I think that the problem, essentially, I think that a lot of people don't get into translation because it really does not pay very well. And I hate to, you know, to bring up the money thing, but that is probably essentially what's inhibiting, and that is probably the greatest impediment to producing more translations, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of commitment, a lot of sweat and tears to produce a translation. And if people aren't being supported, I mean, if people aren't buying the texts, or if people aren't being able to fund the work, it's just not going to happen. And I totally get it. I mean, it took me 2.5 years to finish my text, and that's between running a clinic and having a family and stuff. I mean, it kept me up many nights, and it's a lot of work. And to not get paid to do these things, it's, you know, it has to be a labor of love. But at what point do, you know, people still need to eat and live? So I think that essentially it's a monetary issue, unfortunately.
Could you talk a little bit about the current state of scholarship in traditional Chinese medicine?
I'm not really sure. I think that, you know, like I said before, the undergraduate level is the undergraduate level. It's not really any different than it is in China or North America. I think it's all essentially very similar. I think that in the graduate and postgraduate level, I think that depending on who you're studying with or what school you're studying, the scholarship can be extremely, extremely high. I mean, you know, I've had classes in China which were not very good. I mean, the scholarship was very low, and it really wasn't anything new, or it wasn't anything that we hadn't already delved deep to at the undergraduate level. But I've also been through classes or been sat in clinic with doctors who just blow your mind, who the scholarship is just so high, and there's really a very, very strong knowledge of classical medicine and old literature. And so the scholarship can be very high. As far as how the scholarship is in North America, I can't really speak to that. I'm really not sure. I've been out of school for a while now, so I'm not really sure what the current state of the education is out here.
Could you tell me about any specific areas of interest that scholars of traditional Chinese medicine in North America and China are currently focused on? Just some broad areas.
I think that right now, at least in my experience, there are two schools right now of thought. There are the scholars that are focusing all their energy into research and trying to prove theories and trying to almost biomedicalize the system, which there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's science is great, and Chinese medicine, I think in the right format and the right process can really hold up to the rigors of scientific study. And then there is the school of thought that is heavily based on the literature, on the classics, and really focusing on that.
In your opinion, what could be done to improve the scholarship?
In North America, I think that what is essential would be to teach more Chinese classes. I think that there are a couple schools. There's a school in as far as Canada goes, the only school that I'm aware of is a school out in Nelson that does have a Mandarin element to their program. There's a couple great schools in North America that are also teaching Chinese. And I personally think that that needs to be the focus. I mean, of course, the medicine is important. I think that it has to be taught from the perspective of the classics all the way up to modern works. But I really think there needs to be an emphasis on medical Chinese. People don't have to learn conversational Chinese. They can just learn how to essentially read medical Chinese, because once you can read a little bit of medical Chinese, your entire world is going to open up as far as journals, as far as research, as far as classical texts. I mean, it really opens up an entire ocean of information that is otherwise not provided in the North American education.
How much interest do local practitioners show into the traditional Chinese medicine scholarship?
To be quite honest with you, I'm not sure. Some of the people that I associate with that I know are very, very heavily into the scholarship and are, you know, arduous students of the medicine and, you know, really, really spend their entire, you know, spend their lives under this recognition that we are perpetual students and that we need to consistently learn. But otherwise, I'm really not sure.
Could you briefly talk about the Taoist origins of Chinese medicine?
Sure. I think that essentially the connection between Taoism and Chinese medicine stems back to this concept of holism and this microcosm of the macrocosm. And in Taoist literature, specifically the works of Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching talks about man being a reflection of his environment and the true microcosm within the macrocosm. And, you know, there's talk about harmony and about yin and yang and the five elements and how essentially we are just a reflection of our environment. However, there was a lot of emphasis in Taoist medicine prior to the Han Dynasty in immortality, and there was they would use a lot of medicines to try to achieve immortality, and it wasn't until I believe the Eastern Han Dynasty that Zhang Zhongjing, the writer of the Shanghanza Binglun, really tried to break that down and get into more realistic medical practice, if you will, about actually treating conditions and about looking at the medicine and how it can work. Of course, I mean, you know, Chinese medicine is a holistic medicine, and it does view the environment and humans as this interconnected whole, and that, I mean, that is essentially the tenet of Taoism, really. So I think that there's a strong connection there.
Given that Taoism is so essential to Chinese medicine, why is it so ignored in current TCM education in Vancouver and China?
I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I'm not sure whether it's being taught now in the current systems. But I think that essentially the problem is exactly the same as the classics, is that there really isn't much emphasis put on classical literature. And when we talk about Taoist literature or Confucius literature, they hold just as much weight as the clinical handbooks as well that were written 2,000 years ago, 1,800 years ago. So I think that if a lot of the education systems are foregoing the classical texts, the medical classical texts, then of course they're also going to ignore the Taoist texts, which is, in my opinion, a huge mistake. It's a huge mistake. That I think that in order to understand Chinese medicine, you need to understand its origins, you need to understand its evolution, you need to understand really essentially what it's based on, and I think that truly can make somebody a great practitioner and in really, really getting to the concrete essential understanding of the medicine. So it's really a shame to ignore a lot of these texts.
Is there a difference between Taoist and classical Chinese medicine?
I don't think so. That's a great question. I think that the philosophies are very similar, that they run on basically a lot of the same principles. But of course, classical Chinese medicine is also a hands-on medicine, and there's going to be a clinical application as well, which, I'm not well-versed in a lot of Taoist texts. I have read, of course, the essentials and stuff. But there, as far as the medical practice goes, I'm not really sure how similar it is to the classical system that I've been trained in and that I practice in. Because, even within classical medicine, there are several schools of thought as well that have branched out. I mean, Chinese medicine is this amazing tree that has a multitude of branches. And, the branches are, they're still the tree, right? So, and Taoism is essentially one of the roots, really, of that tree that has provided life and nourishment for the principles behind it. But classical Chinese medicine has just become one of the branches and one of the evolutions of the practice. But I'm not sure.
Any last words you'd like to say to the public?
Any last words? I think that it's a beautiful medicine. It's a very old medicine. I think that for students or even modern day practitioners, I really can't emphasize enough the importance of returning to the source, returning to the classics, reading these books, rereading them, really trying to understand what they were saying, applying them in clinical practice, and being perpetual students. I think it's really, really important to realize that, as practitioners, we can't learn a 2,000-year-old system in a 5-year program or even in 7 years or even in 10 years. My own opinion about the medicine is that I truly won't get it or understand it until I'm on my deathbed. And then I'll have a moment of clarity where it's like, I get it, and I'm fine with that. I have no problem devoting my entire life to understanding and letting this process unravel before me, because it's a beautiful process. And there's too much to read and study in this lifetime anyways. So I can only chip away at it the best that I can. But ultimately, my last words are return to the source.
Very glad to hear it. Thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure. No problem. It was fun.
And that was the second half of an interview with Dr. Avon Evan, a clinic owner, acupuncturist, herbalist, and scholar of classical Chinese medicine. We considered the differences between classical Chinese medicine and contemporary Chinese medicine as practiced today, and further discussed a classical revival and Avon's translation book. For anyone who's interested, Dr. Evan's clinic is located in Port Moody. You can find more information by visiting his website at www.rockypointwellness.com.
This is Bird Note. A flock of gorgeous waterfowl flies above a marsh on the Texas coastline. Large and slender, they have bright pink bills and legs, chestnut necks and backs, and black underparts. Their wings flash boldly, black and white. And as they fly, they whistle. They're called black-bellied whistling ducks, and they're widespread in Central and South America. They've been easy to find in the U.S. along the western Gulf Coast and Florida, but they're also expanding northward. They've been spotted nesting as far north as Wisconsin. The black-bellied's one of 8 species of whistling ducks worldwide, in the tropics and subtropics. Whistling ducks are anything but typical ducks, to which they're only distantly related. Black-bellied whistling ducks are monogamous, and the male and female look alike. At roost during the day, whistling ducks will sometimes stand on tree branches, their long pink legs catching the sun. Late in the day, large flocks gather, then whistle their way overhead at sunset to nighttime feeding areas in fields or along the shore. A lovely and vibrant spectacle with unique sound effects. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Hey, my name's Katie. You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang out with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.